My name is Jeff Merkel, and I'm pastor of University Lutheran Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's a church that's on the campus of Penn, University of Pennsylvania. We call it Penn, as opposed to Penn State. You either go to Penn or to Penn State. If it's Penn, it's Ivy League. If it's Penn State, it's in the center of the state out in the woods. Anyway, I suppose the reason that I'm talking about this thing is because I'm a pastor. I may actually be in the wrong profession because I guess I felt the calling to be a pastor because of powerful experiences of the presence of God that I felt in what you could call wilderness experiences or in situations of being outdoors. One of the early experiences that I had, which really set forth for me what the challenge was in my life, was an experience of climbing Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks. Mount Marcy is a mile-high mountain. It's the highest in the Northeast. And a group of friends and I climbed it late in the day with backpacks, planning to stay overnight on the mountain, which is not the best thing to do because there's no water up there. But we arrived on top maybe around 6:30 or 7 o'clock. And as it was, the sun was setting, we sort of ate some food. And it was about sunset when we were setting up our camp. So we put our sleeping bags out. We didn't have tents, set up a row of backpacks. And I was getting colder and colder. The sun was just about down. And I noticed one of the people that was with us, Les, was not helping us set up this camp, and I felt angry at him because here we were trying to set up this camp and, you know, make a windbreak and all of that stuff, and Les was up on the mountain at the very top of the mountain, as a matter of fact, and he was howling and he was jumping around. He was sort of like dancing, you know, just leaping around like that, and I thought, what on earth is he doing? And I suddenly realized that what he was doing was being immersed in the power of the moment, which I worried about getting colder or my own comfort. I was totally not in touch with the moment. So I went up on the mountain and I danced with Les. And I realized that this was a tremendous breakthrough for me to begin to feel the otherness of the situation, that the beauty around me was not me, and the beauty around me didn't really care about me, but the beauty around me was glorious. And somehow, my being needed to respond to the beauty around me. I believe that this is the beginning of what I'd like to call religious experience, that you see what is objective outside of you, and you allow it to inform you in such a way that you behave differently, or you are changed, you are charged, you are moved by the moment. It can happen not only in the wilderness, it can happen in an art gallery, it can happen at church on Sunday morning, a sudden sense of being surprised by the richness of things. So that's, but for me it was a wilderness experience. I remember another time that very thing happened, and I think it was in the same time span, sometime late in high school. I had made a commitment to sleeping out. I lived in a small town in Pennsylvania. And what I did was every night I would put my sleeping bag on my back and walk about 6 blocks to what we called the Ball Diamond, which was this high school football field, which was no longer used because the high school was now an elementary school. The high school building was now an elementary school. So they didn't need this field anymore, and it was up in the woods. And I would just go up there in the middle of the field, lay out my sleeping bag, and sleep. And I could see all the stars, and that was real important, to be able to see the stars. There's a sense of incredible distance if you're laying there, and instead of looking at a roof or thinking about what happened in the day, you look at the universe. So I was sitting, laying there, looking at the stars, hoping to go to sleep, and it didn't happen. I was just unable to sleep because there were mosquitoes. And also, the deeper I'd crawl into my sleeping bag, the hotter I got because it was a warm night. And so this kind of peculiar confluence of unfortunate details caused me to eventually just burst out of the sleeping bag and start slapping all the mosquitoes that were after me. And I suddenly realized that here I was between eternity, represented by the stars, and the earth, represented by the mosquitoes, and also the ground that I was barefooting around on. And I just sort of broke into another kind of a dance. I think dancing for me is a time of really being open to the wilderness. It's like one way that you can respond. It's one thing to see something beautiful in nature and write about it. It's another thing to see something beautiful in nature and take a picture of it. But when you see something very moving in nature and it so enters you that you can't stand still anymore, it really changes you. It did for me anyway. So those were two experiences that somehow convinced me that I wanted to be about the business of talking about God, talking about the gratitude, the glory of God's love for us. But it really, for me, started in a kind of existential and geographical place. Existential because of the great joy that I felt recognizing that I was sort of between birth and death, that I was by myself. Both of these experiences were sort of experiences of being alone in a place of great vastness, as opposed to a room like this or a community like this. What I'd like to do is talk about some biblical precedents for this experience, this wilderness experience. I think that it's not that the experience of the wilderness is very, very important in Scripture. And the first place that you see it, of course, God creates the universe, and you see God as the creator. That's an important piece, but much more of an experience of wilderness is the experience of the people of Israel when they are led through the Red Sea out into the wilderness by Moses. They have been in a civilized place. Egypt was the New York City of the Middle East. I mean, it was this incredibly urbanized culture, very gifted and skilled technologically. And the Jews were actually living pretty well. They were slaves, but they were living pretty well. Because if you live in a place where people have mastered technology, you are fairly comfortable, many of your needs are met. And we find this when the Israelites are leaving Egypt and going into the wilderness. They're continually complaining. They're saying, "Why did we leave the leeks and the watermelons and everything of Egypt to be in this place where we have no certainty and no comfort?" And they said to Moses, "Will you not give us something to hold on to, some way of being hopeful in this place?" And Moses went to God and said, "Why did you ask me to bring this people into this wilderness if they are going to be continually reviling me and reviling you?" And God says, "I'll take care of it." And you know what God does? Brings manna into the wilderness, the bread that appears in the morning on the ground, and the people go out and they collect the bread in the wilderness. That experience is a very profound experience for the people of Israel, because living in the desert is a very, very difficult thing. It's a very challenging, frightening experience to have no idea where you're going, to have no idea how long you're going to be at it, and also not to know if there's going to be water and food at the end of the line each day. So it becomes a daily struggle of existence. But God responds precisely in that place of wilderness, that place of fear, that place of otherness. And so In a sense, God declares himself or herself to be a God of wilderness, to be a God who comes through when we are most in need. It's a very, very interesting idea about God, because most other cultures believed that God was that their gods, or their God, if they had a one God system, most of them had many gods, that those gods were gods who really came through when you were most successful, and who were present when you were most successful, not when you were most in need. But Israel's God is a God who appears precisely where they're most in need, in the midst of the wilderness. Even when the people are complaining, God comes through. So there's some pieces of our our Christian God that we see in Jesus. Those pieces are already there. I mean, Jesus really reveals God's compassion for the poor, God's care for the sick, in a very concrete way. But we see it already, that God is a God of those who are lost in the wilderness and takes care of them. It's not lost on Jesus that God nurtures in the wilderness, because Jesus himself goes out into the wilderness at the beginning of his ministry. This is the second biblical image that I want to bring out, because I always find it to be one of the more exciting preaching Sundays. It's always the first Sunday in Lent, to talk about the fact that Jesus, who is equal with God, goes into the desert for 40 days. Why? It's always challenging to me. Why did Jesus want to be hungry for 40 days, to thirst for 40 days? What was happening for Jesus at that time? What was God doing with Jesus? What was God teaching Jesus? Certainly, there's one sense in which the 40 reminds us of the 40 years in the wilderness. 40 days for Jesus, 40 years in the wilderness for the Israelites. Jesus is sort of reliving, in a sense, the absolute trust in God that the Israelite people had to learn by going to the wilderness, the place of forsakenness, the place of having no control over your life and trusting entirely in God. And you know that after Jesus is there for 40 days, that's when Satan comes and starts talking to him in the Matthew and Luke version. And Satan asks Jesus, if you're the Son of God, why not make these stones into bread? Isn't that interesting? Make these stones into bread, because bread, manna in the wilderness, is precisely how God feeds the people of Israel. The devil challenges Jesus to feed himself. God is saying, feed yourself. You have the power, feed yourself. And Jesus, remembering that God fed the Israelites, that God was trustworthy, said, no. People are not to live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And then there's the other two temptations, you recall, the one of going to the pinnacle of the temple and jumping down because God will take care of him if he is the Son of God, and Jesus says you're not supposed to tempt God. And then the third one, where all the countries of the world are spread out and the devil says, I will make these yours, and if you bow down, he says, you are to worship only God, away from me, and Satan disappears. Again, a wilderness experience which is central to the ministry of Jesus, because it's the time when Jesus says to himself, as well as to Satan, that he himself is not going to take care of himself, but he is going to go into the wilderness through his ministry. He's going to give up his own control. He's not going to himself gain all the nations of the world, or himself by flashy acts of power, like jumping off of the pinnacle of the temple, win people's love to him, but he is going to trust in God. Again, a wilderness experience, which is central. The third one that I want to talk about, which ties the two together, really, is when Jesus feeds the 5,000. It's a story that comes up in all four of the Gospels, which is a rarity. And it happens in the wilderness. The Greek term for wilderness is a deserted place, desert, a lonely place. Also, a place where nothing grows. So Jesus is in this particular lonely place. You know, he goes across the Sea of Galilee to be alone because he needs, once again, to refresh himself by prayer, by trusting in God, just to be away. I don't know if any of you have done that yet here at Holden, to just go out for a half a mile and just stand there where nobody else is and be away. It's precisely what Jesus wanted to do, and you can imagine what it would be like if you were going up to the ball field to be away, and all of a sudden all of these people came following after you, you know, trying to keep up with you. It's what happened to Jesus. They rode across the lake, the people followed around the outside, and Jesus saw them, and was he angry? He, who was trying to get some time alone after working so hard, he wasn't angry. He says he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. They were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And so he tells the disciples to sit them down. And Jesus, again, trusting in God, gives thanks over the loaves and fishes, and there is enough food to feed all of the people. And it must have been to the people, who, all of them Jews, who were very well schooled in the Old Testament and in the great story of their salvation through the desert and the manna story, it really was another manna story for them. It was sort of taking the story of this food that was there every morning for the Israelites, it was taking that image and once again showing that when people trust in God, God comes through. So the wilderness becomes a place where people enter into fear, enter into a place of abandonment, and God comes and nurtures them and cares for them. So wilderness is both of these things, as I say over here. Wilderness is a place of confrontation. It's a forbidding and dangerous place. We're afraid to go to the wilderness. We're afraid to be alone in the wilderness. It's a deserted place. We're all by ourselves. But when we go there, frequently the wilderness is a place of insight, nurture, surprise, and grace. Instead of being abandoned, instead of dying, we find that we learn new things about ourselves. And what we learn primarily, at least in this context as I'm talking about it, if we trust in God, we discover that God does not abandon us. That when we thought that God, when we thought that we needed to take care of ourselves somehow, when the people of Israel thought, Moses, you haven't brought along a wagon train of food, how are we going to eat? When they thought that they were most abandoned, God was able to show them God's love for them. And the same is true, I think, of us in our lives. When we are constantly taking care of all the contingencies in our lives, when we're constantly making every experience and every part of our life into a civilized thing, taking control of it, making sure that nothing goes wrong, making sure that the plans are all laid out, where is it possible for God to come in and to show us grace? Where is it possible? It's possible in places where that control is taken away from us, as in a death, or a sickness, or a failure. When we find out that what we wanted to do and spent 2 years trying to do is not possible for us, in a divorce, in the death of a child, or in a miscarriage, in betrayal by another person. Those are the places where we're cast into wilderness because we never willingly, most of us, go into wilderness because we try as much as we can to keep the world around us tremendously civilized and under control. Now, I've worked on a little chart here which isn't terribly systematic, but it's an attempt to help all of us to recognize that wilderness is not just a geographical space, it's also an existential space, so that each one of us, whether we've never hiked or whether we hike all the time, whether we've never been in a place where we've needed a tent or slept outside overnight, or if we do that a lot, nevertheless, there's wilderness in our lives. I have two poles on the top here, across the top here. One is the very human, and one is, I term the other, something that is not human, something that is beyond human. Some people would say that we invent God out of, and they would say that this is all human, but I don't believe that. I believe that there is a God. I believe that there is a lot of stuff out there that we can't begin to comprehend, and that we are simply sojourners in a huge world of potential meaning, and that we only know a little bit of it. So I call that other pole, I call it the other. Then I have two different significations over here. One is civilized, those things that are known to us, and the other is wilderness, the unknown, which is also a place of ecstasy and despair, as I understand it. Though I think civilized can be a place where there's joy and sadness, maybe. But ecstasy and despair, I think, are, by definition, so filled with energy that they come from a place which is more wilderness than civilization. That's why you can't be a very controlled person. If you have your life under control, I think you will never know ecstasy and despair until it comes and bats you over the head. I mean, in a death, or in a birth, or in some kind of surprise that just came out of the blue. You had no idea it was coming. I think ecstasy and despair are more along the wilderness contingent, and that other kinds of emotions, joy, those are more controlled. So I'm going across the top here from human. The self is that which is most you, most human. Community is you and your family and friends. Tradition is something that goes beyond the present. Community is in the present, right now. This is community. Tradition would be all the people who have ever sat in this room, back to 1962 when Holden was given to the Lutherans. So tradition goes through time, whereas community is more of a here and now kind of thing. I put nature down there. I didn't have this originally, but I see nature as also moving. We go beyond tradition to nature, which is really, I was talking to Rick Dunning yesterday, and he was telling me about how, and maybe those of you who've sat in on his classes know how minuscule our little piece of time here on the world is compared to the geological scale. And some of the things that he was saying was, if you think of all geological history, the history of the Earth, is that it? As a year, as 1 year, when did humans come on? Do you know that?
Probably a few minutes. All of human history, about an hour or so.
All of human history, an hour of a whole year. So nature, I'm moving toward the other, because nature is so far beyond just tradition in terms of time scale. The other, capital O, is that which is God, I believe. And so that is even, in my mind, beyond nature, that God was before matter existed and God will continue to exist. So now I break it down into two ways of thinking about it. One is the civilized and known way of thinking about each of these five. The other is the wilderness and unknown way of thinking about it. Take yourself, for example. If I ask you who you are, you'll tell me, and we do this all the time, I'll go, well, my name is Jeff Werkel. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I work as a pastor. Those are the three pieces that you want. If you're from a family, then you also say, and I have three children, and this is my wife, so-and-so, or husband, so-and-so. So that kind of stuff, which is civilized, known, gives you some joy and sadness. The verbal things that you say about yourself. Well, now, down here, the wilderness area is the non-verbals. You tell me all of that stuff, but there's a sad look on your face. Or you tell me these things, but you don't tell me the fact that your youngest child got hit by a car last year and is crippled, or something like that. These wilderness experiences that you may begin to tell me about yourself if I get to know you very well, your fears and sadness, the things that are too deep for words and the things that you can't really hide because they are nonverbal, but maybe you won't talk about them. When you get to community, the civilized part is your family, your friends, the work that you do together, the plans that you made, there may be other things, I couldn't think of anything. But the wilderness part are the deeper things, the jealousy, the betrayal, the love. I mean, love is really an unknown. We talk about it a lot, but it is so unknown. Why are there so many divorces? Because we don't know anything about love. We feel it, we are powerfully moved by it, but when it comes down to it, our community, our ability to love is beyond our understanding. And we say to someone, I love you, and we don't know if we do or not. We want to, we wish we could, but maybe we can't. And that's what's down here. Also issues of abandonment. It's a wilderness area. It's a place of great power it's confrontation forbidding, insight nurture. That's the kind of place wilderness is. In the tradition...
Wait. Are you suggesting that the physical wilderness promotes these things in the lower...
No, I'm not saying physical wilderness. I would put physical wilderness over here. Physical wilderness would be... But this is the existential wilderness.
Okay. But not the geographic.
Not the geographic. This is the geographic.
If you go on a long hike, you turn into all those things on the bottom. That's what I get out of it. Let's get that on the table.
Okay. In tradition... the known part, and I'd put church up here, I'd also put faith up here. History, our nation, language, things like that. The wilderness part of tradition, though, are things like the Inquisition, Spanish Inquisition. I had Hitler up here for a while, took it off. Sacraments are definitely part of the tradition that is deep. It's not explainable. You can ask me, what is the body and blood of Christ? I'm a pastor, I've learned all the answers, but I'd still tell you it's a mystery. That's another thing that we could put down here, just mystery. The things that put us in touch with mystery. Our forebears, our grandparents and great-grandparents are part of the tradition that touch us in a deep way, or can touch us in a deep way, depending on how we talk about them. Again, nature. There's the civilized part of nature. Nature is a resource. You just cut down the trees and use them. Or ecology. It can also be the same thing. You just keep the trees from being cut down. But on the wilderness side of nature are quests or searches to find yourself. Jesus going out into the wilderness for these 40 days. The idea of the people of Israel being in the wilderness for 40 years. Something very powerful can happen in the midst of nature because getting further down the road to the other, and I actually suggest that the more you go in this direction, which I can't do anymore because of this magic marker, and the more you go in this direction, the more powerful the experiences get. So then finally we come down here to the other. We see God in Jesus Christ is actually a very knowable kind of thing. You can see he's a man, he heals the poor, he talks about parables, he does all of these things. Scripture is another thing that you can hold in your hands and see and think about. Metaphors for God. God is a mighty fortress. God is all of the metaphors of Scripture. I can't think of any now. But on the wilderness side of God, you have mysticism. People who search for God through prayer and through meditation and through being silent for years. The dark night of the soul is the other side of that, which is the struggle of the abandonment, feeling like God isn't present, the sadness, but waiting on God. This is really the realm of the Holy Spirit down here, which got wiped down a little bit. Whereas Jesus is God that we see, the Holy Spirit is God that is really beyond us. And sometimes we don't get that in Trinitarian theology because we think God, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. There's some real differences there. God, the Son, Jesus Christ, is someone that we can see and touch and hold, God the Holy Spirit is beyond us, empowers us, nurtures us.
You said as you move down and across, the experiences are more powerful. Does that mean more desirable?
I guess more wildernessy. I mean, you're more out of control dealing with things like mysticism than you are with nonverbals. And you're more out of control with this than with the sacraments. Because this really doesn't, there's no definition there. It's sort of like raw godness down here in the corner. This is really, and that's why I like to talk about wilderness spirituality, because it's getting close to it, and it's something that many people have struggled with, and many people have experienced. I mean, when you go on a hike, and you finally get to where you are, and you're looking out over the expanse of things, Rick and I were on top of Mount Furno yesterday, just looking out all over the North Cascades, and it's a time when you can start to ask, who am I? What can be? I mean, holding can be that for people. Holding can also be tradition, where people come back and say, it isn't the way it used to be, you know, or community. What I find for a lot of people who come here, the community is so wonderful for them on some level that they spend most of their time talking to people, getting to know people, getting addresses, all of that stuff. And some stuff down here of feeling drawn to people and afraid of people and things like that, but it may not get into the spirit of place in the sense of Holden. When you walk in here, you sense something totally, powerfully other. That would definitely be spirit of place.
Also, the suggestion was in our group that unless you take enough time to be quiet, like here, that you will stay too much into the ego or into the community, and you will never experience Holden as something quite different from what you have at home.
That's a really interesting piece of this whole wilderness spirituality, because in a sense you can take almost every potential wilderness and civilize it just by keeping it under control. You can fall in love, so-called fall in love with somebody, and never experience deep love just by doing everything you're supposed to do as you get married and have children, you know, get old. So there's, I mean, it's kind of hard in relationships to avoid experiences of other, but you can do it, you know, if you really try hard. Some people manage to do it because they're so afraid of the other or being out of control in relationship. Other people?
I wonder if sometimes if we get into this wilderness and we don't pursue it, and we give up and never do really work ourselves out of it. I can think of a time in our marriage when I had three little children, and you just feel trapped.
Yeah.
You just feel trapped. No money, no help, no nothing. It would have been so easy for me to back out of it. And I think at this day and age, I probably would have walked out.
Mm-hmm.
But when you work it out, you know, because that was the thing to do then, it develops into something that's really very great.
Mm-hmm.
And so probably if people realize that more, that they have to, there is a wilderness,
mm-hmm.
and there's something beyond that.
Mm-hmm. That you can be obedient to the wilderness in a certain sense. Even though it feels awful or trapping or just
a lot of times with the death, you can't walk out of it. You have to work yourself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
With something like a marriage, you can't. We attempt too much, I think, to work our own way out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
the perception
really
of a wilderness, though, as it's expressed here. I've never heard it as we're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an education and enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's putting a word on something that we, you know, we always think of the wilderness as you go going out into an area and becoming overboard.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many other wildernesses that
mm-hmm.
are out there.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
Yeah.
Now that's an experience that happened to me out in the wilderness, was being made aware of the unity of everything, like I was one with the rocks and the trees and the animals and so forth, and there wasn't any individualism left. It was just the spirit, essentially, is what the experience was.
Mm-hmm. Have other people had that experience in being out in nature?
Oh, yeah.
I think I've experienced that in St. Helens when that blew. And we were hit with the second time that it erupted. And we were getting ready for church, and it was like night.
Really?
You know, and you wondered, well, were you going to come through this?
Huh. Yeah.
Something beyond your control, you knew.
Yeah. Here it was.
Yeah.
Night, and it was day.
Wow.
And that's all it is.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine how, I mean, some of the stuff that we see in the Bible today, we can, which was awesome to the Israelites and to early peoples, we can sort of say, well, scientifically we know what that was. But even though scientifically you knew what it was,
that's
there
right.
was still this
the
sense
power of God.
Power and all.
More powerful than the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm.
Going back to a grasshopper plague, interesting challenge. How do I deal with it? Where's it at? Mm-hmm. To me at this point, to my hometown, farm system, you know, the ramifications of the human wilderness, I guess it's really a tremendous wilderness out there.
Mm-hmm.
Unknowns. The old people, you know, are saying solutions, not being listened to.
Mm-hmm.
Ecology is being totally destroyed in my initial judgment right at this point.
And where is this?
Western Minnesota.
Huh.
And
because of the kind of farming, you mean, that people are...
Well, no, grasshoppers are taking over.
Oh, they're taking over?
Yeah.
Oh.
We're talking 40 per meter on a low scale up to 1,000 per meter on major scale. So it's, you know, it's being a wipeout, total financial wipeout. Gail, so we're going back to this issue,
uh-huh.
you know, of the support of God's creation,
uh-huh.
you know, and how we are to be stewards of it.
Yeah.
And the normal response that I'm just absolutely horrible with is the spraying, the killing,
mm-hmm.
the mechanisms of solution, which is not a solution. It's just a perpetuation of something a lot worse,
mm-hmm.
bigger monster than what we can deal with now. Allow nature to take its own. Because you're going to kill all the natural defenses.
Mm-hmm.
But if the crops are destroyed and there's nothing to feed the grasshoppers, they in turn will disappear, no?
That's right. Delete
and you'd have to come...
Cannibalistic. They're very cannibalistic.
They eat each other?
And then you'd have to come and renew what was destroyed.
Well, it'll be there.
Except for the financial, of course, this is easy said.
The beauty around me was not me, and the beauty around me didn't really care about me, but the beauty around me was glorious. And somehow, my being needed to respond to the beauty around me. I believe that this is the beginning of what I'd like to call religious experience, that you see what is objective outside of you and you allow it to inform you in such a way that you behave differently, or you are changed, you are charged, you are moved by the moment. It can happen not only in the wilderness, it can happen in an art gallery, it can happen at church on Sunday morning, a sudden sense of being surprised by the richness of things. So that's, but for me it was a
a wilderness experience. I remember another time that that very thing happened, and I think it was in the same time span, sometime late in high school. I had made a commitment to sleeping out. I lived in a small town in Pennsylvania. And what I did was every night I would put my sleeping bag on my back and walk about 6 blocks to what we called the Ball Diamond, which was this high school football field, which was no longer used because the high school was now an elementary school. The high school building was now an elementary school. So they didn't need this field anymore, and it was up in the woods. And I would just go up there in the middle of the field, lay out my sleeping bag, and sleep. And I could see all the stars, and that was real important, to be able to see the stars. There's a sense of incredible distance if you're laying there, and instead of looking at a roof or thinking about what happened in the day, you look at the universe. So I was sitting, laying there, looking at the stars, hoping to go to sleep, and it didn't happen. I was just unable to sleep because there were mosquitoes. And also, the deeper I'd crawl into my sleeping bag, the hotter I got because it was a warm night. And so this kind of peculiar confluence of unfortunate details caused me to eventually just burst out of the sleeping bag and start slapping all the mosquitoes that were after me. And I suddenly realized that here I was between eternity, represented by the stars, and the earth, represented by the mosquitoes, and also the ground that I was barefooting around on. And I just sort of broke into another kind of a dance. I think dancing for me is a time of really being open to the wilderness. It's like one way that you can respond. It's one thing to see something beautiful in nature and write about it. It's another thing to see something beautiful in nature and take a picture of it. But when you see something very moving in nature and it so enters you that you can't stand still anymore, it really changes you. It did for me anyway. So those were two experiences that somehow convinced me that I wanted to be about the business of talking about God, talking about the gratitude, the glory of God's love for us. But it really, for me, started in a kind of existential and geographical place. Existential because of the great joy that I felt recognizing that I was sort of between birth and death, that I was by myself. Both of these experiences were sort of experiences of being alone in a place of great vastness, as opposed to a room like this or a community like this. What I'd like to do is talk about some biblical precedents for this experience, this wilderness experience. I think that it's not that the experience of the wilderness is very, very important in Scripture. And the first place that you see it, of course, God creates the universe, and you see God as the creator. That's an important piece, but much more of an experience of wilderness is the experience of the people of Israel when they are led through the Red Sea out into the wilderness by Moses. They have been in a civilized place. Egypt was the New York City of the Middle East. I mean, it was this incredibly urbanized culture, very gifted and skilled technologically. And the Jews were actually living pretty well. They were slaves, but they were living pretty well. Because if you live in a place where people have mastered technology, you are fairly comfortable. Many of your needs are met. And we find this when the Israelites are leaving Egypt and going into the into the wilderness, they're continually complaining. They're saying, why did we leave the leeks and the watermelons and everything of Egypt to be in this place where we have no certainty and no comfort? And they said to Moses, will you not give us something to hold on to, some way of being hopeful in this place? And Moses went to God and said, why did you asked me to bring this people into this wilderness if they are going to be continually reviling me and reviling you. And God says, I'll take care of it. And you know what God does? Brings manna into the wilderness, the bread that appears in the morning on the ground, and the people go out and they collect the bread in the wilderness. That experience is a very profound experience for the people of Israel, because living in the desert is a very, very difficult thing. It's a very challenging, frightening experience to have no idea where you're going, to have no idea how long you're going to be at it, and also not to know if there's going to be water and food at the end of the line each day. So it becomes a daily struggle of existence. But God responds precisely in that place of wilderness, that place of fear, that place of otherness. And so, in a sense, God declares himself, for herself, to be a God of wilderness, to be a God who comes through when we are most in need. That's a very, very interesting idea about God, because most other cultures believed that God was that their gods, or their God, if they had a one God system, most of them had many gods, that those gods were gods who really came through when you were most successful, and who were present when you were most successful, not when you were most in need. But Israel's God is a God who appears precisely where they're most in need, in the midst of the wilderness. Even when the people are complaining, God comes through. So there's some pieces of our of our Christian God that we see in Jesus. Those pieces are already there. I mean, Jesus really reveals God's compassion for the poor, God's care for the sick, in a very concrete way, but we see it already, that God is a God of those who are lost in the wilderness and takes care of them. It's not lost on Jesus that God nurtures in the wilderness, because Jesus himself goes out into the wilderness at the beginning of his ministry. This is the second biblical image that I want to bring out, because I always find it to be one of the more exciting preaching Sundays. It's always the first Sunday in Lent, to talk about the fact that Jesus, who is equal with God, goes into the desert for 40 days. Why? It's always challenging to me. Why did Jesus want to be hungry for 40 days, to thirst for 40 days? What was happening for Jesus at that time? What was God doing with Jesus? What was God teaching Jesus? Certainly, there's one sense in which the 40 reminds us of the 40 years in the wilderness. 40 days for Jesus, 40 years in the wilderness for the Israelites. Jesus is sort of reliving, in a sense, the absolute trust in God that the Israelite people had to learn by going to the wilderness, the place of forsakenness, the place of having no control over your life and trusting entirely in God. And you know that after Jesus is there for 40 days, that's when Satan comes and starts talking to him in the Matthew and Luke version. And Satan asks Jesus, if you're the Son of God, why not make these stones into bread? Isn't that interesting? Make these stones into bread, because bread, manna in the wilderness, is precisely how God feeds the people of Israel. The devil challenges Jesus to feed himself. God is saying, feed yourself. You have the power. Feed yourself. And Jesus, remembering that God fed the Israelites, that God was trustworthy, said, no. People are not to live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And then there's the other two temptations. You recall the one of going to the pinnacle of the temple and jumping down because God will take care of him if he is the Son of God. And Jesus says, you're not supposed to tempt God. And then the third one, where all the countries of the world are spread out, and the devil says, I will make these yours. And if you bow down, he says, you are to worship only God, away from me, and Satan disappears. Again, a wilderness experience which is central to the ministry of Jesus, because it's the time when Jesus says to himself, as well as to Satan, that he himself is not going to take care of himself, but he is going to go into the wilderness through his ministry. He's going to give up his own control. He's not going to himself gain all the nations of the world, or himself by flashy acts of power, like jumping off of the pinnacle of the temple, win people's love to him, but he is going to trust in God. Again, a wilderness experience, which is central. The third one that I want to talk about, which ties the two together really, is when Jesus feeds the 5,000. It's a story that comes up in all four of the Gospels, which is a rarity. And it happens in the wilderness. The Greek term for wilderness is a deserted place, desert, a lonely place. Also, a place where nothing grows. So Jesus is in this particular lonely place. You know, he goes across the Sea of Galilee to be alone because he needs, once again, to refresh himself by prayer, by trusting in God, just to be away. I don't know if any of you have done that yet here at Holden, to just go out for a half a mile and just stand there where nobody else is and be away. It's precisely what Jesus wanted to do, and you can imagine what it would be like if you were going up to the ball field to be away, and all of a sudden all of these people came following after you, you know, trying to keep up with you. It's what happened to Jesus. They rode across the lake, the people followed around the outside, and Jesus saw them, and was he angry? He, who was trying to get some time alone after working so hard, he wasn't angry. He says he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. They were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. And so he tells the disciples to sit them down. And Jesus, again, trusting in God, gives thanks over the loaves and fishes, and there is enough food to feed all of the people. And it must have been to the people, who, all of them Jews, who were very well schooled in the Old Testament and in the great story of their salvation through the desert and the manna story, it really was another manna story for them. It was sort of taking the story of this food that was there every morning for the Israelites, it was taking that image and once again showing that when people trust in God, God comes through. The wilderness becomes a place where people enter into fear, enter into a place of abandonment, and God comes and nurtures them and cares for them. So wilderness is both of these things, as I say over here. Wilderness is a place of confrontation. It's a forbidding and dangerous place. We're afraid to go to the wilderness. We're afraid to be alone in the wilderness. It's a deserted place. We're all by ourselves. But when we go there, frequently the wilderness is a place of insight, nurture, surprise, and grace. Instead of being abandoned, instead of dying, we find that we learn new things about ourselves. And what we learn primarily, at least in this context as I'm talking about it, if we trust in God, we discover that God does not abandon us. That when we thought that God, when we thought that we needed to take care of ourselves somehow, when the people of Israel thought, Moses, you haven't brought along a wagon train of food, how are we going to eat? When they thought that they were most abandoned, God was able to show them God's love for them. And the same is true, I think, of us in our lives. When we are constantly taking care of all the contingencies in our lives, when we're constantly making every experience and every part of our life into a civilized thing, taking control of it, making sure that nothing goes wrong, making sure that the plans are all laid out, where is it possible for God to come in and to show us grace? Where is it possible? It's possible in places where that control is taken away from us, as in a death, or a sickness, or a failure, when we find out that, that what we wanted to do and spent 2 years trying to do is not possible for us, in a divorce, in the death of a child or in a miscarriage, in betrayal by another person. Those are the places where we're cast into wilderness because we never willingly, most of us, go into wilderness because we try as much as we can to keep the world around us tremendously civilized and under control. Now, I've worked on a little chart here which isn't terribly systematic, but it's an attempt to help all of us to recognize that wilderness is not just a geographical space, it's also an existential space, so that each one of us, whether we've never hiked or whether we hike all the time, whether we've never been in a place where we've needed a tent or slept outside overnight, or if we do that a lot, nevertheless, there's wilderness in our lives.